Are you feeling at all petulant today, Richard?
I mean, I usually am.
Are you feeling as petulant as the Elan of Troyes?
No, because I've had an antacid and I'm feeling better.
Is that what she needed? She needed an antacid?
Usually.
Maybe it was the green chicken she was eating.
I loved that. I love how, like, alien food is just chicken with green food dye on it.
I'm just going to assume that that was marker. Because the show had no budget. So that actress was actually poisoned.
I was going to say, fun fact, she died a week later.
Yeah, she did. And the guy who played the ambassador also died.
Because she actually stabbed him for the role.
Yeah. So, Elan of Troyes.
I mean, it was certainly an episode of Star Trek.
I like this one.
I didn't hate this one.
It is a show. It's an episode of the show that rises above itself. Mostly on the strength of the guest cast. I love the actress who plays Elan.
Yeah.
She's really good. And she takes a role that could have seemed really, really, really sexist and almost convinces us that it's not.
It's very interesting.
Maybe.
My main issue with her character is these magic mind control tears that she has. That's the crux of a lot of the problems I had with this character.
Yeah.
So, in other words, you have this woman who, she is in this position of great power. She can, you know, commands this retinue of servants. What she says goes. She is, you know, every whim of hers is catered to. Except she really has no power because she is forced into this marriage that she obviously does not want for the sake of a peace treaty.
Which seems to indicate that she is not the leader, but she is the heir apparent or figurehead.
This is, you know, was extremely she's almost I was wondering if they would go a Marie Antoinette route with it because it was that kind of a marriage, which I know is obviously extremely common, but she's not happy about it. And it's interesting because very obviously her behavior in the early stages of the episode, where she is finding fault with everything and she's just screaming and yelling, is a way for her to assert whatever tiny power she has. In other words, she's not able to alter the course of her own life. She does not have self-determination. So she's just going to use her power to piss everybody off, because at least that's one thing she can do.
Yeah, I totally understand that, and I see that.
Where that could go, essentially Kirk begins to soften towards her because she puts this love spell on him, rather than him being able to see that is where she is coming from. If where the episode had gone from was him realizing, all right, she's not acting this way just because she's a horrible person. She's acting this way because this is all she has.
I thought the episode was going to go in a slightly different direction, because you do have that one scene of McCoy trying to develop an antidote for the tears,
yeah,
which is never resolved and doesn't really go anywhere. And the ambassador says, basically, don't even waste your time. There's no antidote to the tears of a woman from a loss and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And I thought the end of the episode was going to be McCoy discovering that it's basically an urban legend and the tears have no effect. And so this was some sort of, like, you know, snow job that the women of this planet were putting on people so that they had some sort of place in their society. And they kind of just dropped the entire thing, which I thought was problematic.
Well, at the very end, they basically say, well, you know, he has his ship again and that's that. And, you know, they're not together anyway, and they've learned to, and she's not going to, and that's what's going to happen.
Basically implying that Kirk is not going to cheat on the Enterprise, which is weird, and also doesn't jive with what we know about Kirk, because he sleeps with many ladies, even in one of last week's episodes.
He fucks women, he loves the Enterprise. And poor Yeoman Rand. Yeah, the fact that he didn't come to that realization through natural means. Again, if the two of them had talked to each other and it had been an urban legend, or it, you know, hadn't had that element at all, I think it would have been much stronger, because it would have come across as an actual realization on Kirk's part rather than kind of a mind-controlled thing. And they do it to no real purpose. For a while, I thought, okay, well, she's going to really be evil and, you know, take over. But that doesn't really happen. She kind of uses the mind control to, you know, start dating Kirk, which could have happened anyway. You know, she doesn't, you know, once she and he begin to spend more time together, she naturally begins to soften and begins to realize, you know, the obligations that she has. So it felt very unnecessary.
Yeah, that's the weird thing is that, you know, I like the episode, but there's a lot of it which feels like fake outs, and a lot of it feels a lot less intense than it could have, because I mean, there's that whole thing about, you know, I thought the tears were going to be some sort of fake out.
Yeah.
You've got her basically taking control of Kirk in a magical fashion, if we can say that. And in previous episodes of the show, that has definitely been something that the evil people do to take over the ship and kill people.
Yeah.
Which doesn't turn out to be the case. She just sort of does it because she wants Kirk to like her, which is strange. And then you've got this other subplot, which we haven't touched on yet, with the Klingons.
Yeah.
And it doesn't, I mean, I can kind of understand why the Klingons are in the episode, because it lends an aura of danger to the episode that otherwise would not have been there.
Yes.
But I'm not necessarily sure that it needed to be there, because if the script had gone in a more interesting direction and it basically just been a character study on the level of something like Journey to Babel, I think it could have been a lot more interesting. As it is, it's a little half-baked, I think.
Well, they also give no real rationale to that. If there had been, in a way, if the problems with whatever her name, the Khaleesi or whatever she is if they had dealt with, if that had been compounding this Klingon situation, you know, the two of them bouncing off each other.
Well, that's
what they intended to do, but they don't really give a reason why.
That's what I thought. I thought originally that she was in cahoots with the Klingons and she was doing something to Kirk so that the Klingons would take over the ship. I, you know, who knows?
And then they had one of the people in her crew who, you know, and then I thought it was going to be, because when he kills himself, he just kind of like phasers himself out of existence. So I thought they were going to do, in Trouble with Tribbles, they had that where somebody was a Klingon in disguise.
Right.
I thought it would be something like that. And they just kind of go, well, he was a member of, you know, one of the oldest noble families, so therefore not a Klingon. And, well, I guess he did that because he loved me and was jealous. So he decided to sell the entire system out to the Klingon.
It doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
We've talked about, you know, first draft-itis in this, and they needed to give him, and they just kind of, that felt like the shoehorned in, you know, there needs to be a motivation, we'll fix that in the next draft, and they never got around to that.
Yeah, and it's a little upsetting, because I can definitely see a version of this episode where it's all about Elan trying to fit in with this society, learning lessons, Kirk teaching her, and get rid of the Klingons, get rid of the subplot with the guy trying to sabotage the ship because who cares, and all these kind of things. And it could have been a much more a personal story, and we just kind of get this, you know, it's not a bad episode, but it doesn't really go anywhere, and it doesn't really serve a whole lot of purpose.
If it had been a way, it wanted to be an episode dealing with the various obligations that one has. Now,
yeah, and I think that
a
parallel there could have been drawn much more clearly between Elan and Kirk, and it never really was, for one thing. And I think the other problematic aspect of the episode is that they cast, as much as I like the actress who plays Elan, and a lot of the charm and a lot of the fun of the episode comes from her portrayal of this character, I think that they should have gone younger, because it would have been much more of a sort of like, this is a 12 or 13 year old girl who doesn't have a whole lot of life experience, but she has a lot of power some reason. And, you know, it could have made it more of like an Eliza Doolittle sort of thing.
I would have gone in the middle, like split the difference, make her about 20. So that way she's not.
Well, I thought that's how old she was supposed to be.
I don't know. Like she could, which given that she's a, you know, dowry bride, basically, you know, a treaty bride, you know, does make sense with that. I don't know. I'm not really good at telling the ages of women. I have no need for it.
I mean, I don't know how old the actress was, but I assume that she was probably supposed to be, you know, 20, 25 years old. I certainly don't think she was supposed to be any older than that. And yeah, I think by going younger, it would have taken a lot of the romantic subtext out of the episode. Maybe not because Miri, but...
But I like the romantic subtext because one of the main themes of the episode that they try to do is what one must give up in order to, you know, fulfill one's obligations. I mean, he's talking, he talks to the ambassador. The ambassador is basically says at one point, like, this is really hard. And Kirk, I mean, and this is throughout, has no patience for people who do, who complain about their jobs. He, if you, you know, you're here, you're in this position. Yeah, it sucks that you don't get to do these things because you're busy, you know, exploring the galaxy, but, you know, suck it up. That's what you do. And, you know, that's essentially what he tells the ambassador. Like, you've got to find a way. This is your job.
Yeah, yeah.
He's telling her, you know, he has to give up, you know, the love of this woman in order to, you know, do his duty. He can't give... If he wanted to, he could say, well, look, I'm going to just hang out there and be her, you know, her catamite. That happens. You know, that is something that could be done. But no, he needs to be doing his mission. She needs to get married. She needs to do this because that's what the... Now, of course, there is the fact that Kirk has chosen his duty and he's not upset with it. At the end of the day, the Enterprise is the love of his life. And while he may regret certain decisions and while he may have difficulty making certain decisions, I don't think the decision at the end of this episode was an easy one, he certainly... makes the he will always do the Enterprise because at the end of the day he knows that's the rewarding one, that's where he belongs, that's what fulfills him in the best way. He is essentially telling her that she can't complain for doing an obligation that she did not choose.
Right. And well, that, I mean, that is a little problematic.
It is greater than her, and yes, certainly I think, you know, one of his things is she is in the position to end a war by this, and certainly her individual life is not as, you know, needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. You know, the needs of the many outweigh her personal decision to love the person she wants to.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because I mean, we can go back to Elan in a little while, but what purpose does the Federation have in even trying to appease these two planets? I mean, they do say that the Federation claims this solar system, which implies that these planets are not members of the Federation. So maybe I don't really get that. They're sort of supposed to be maybe territories or something. But at the end of the episode where the ambassador gives Elan the necklace, which turns out to be dilithium crystals. And of course that saves the day because the dilithium crystals were the part of the ship that were sabotaged by one of her guards. And then therefore the ship is saved, which, you know, I liked that little bit of plotting, but they don't know that the dilithium crystals are there. They think that comes as a surprise to them because the Klingons, they say, oh, well, this is why the Klingons want this planet.
I want to say, Kirk and the staff of the Enterprise do not know that the
That's fair.
On here. I was going to say, because can you think of any real world applications in which one government decided to protect another country at war with another in order to gain resources? Like, I can't think of any time that's happened.
But I will say this, we've never really seen the Federation to be an entity or an organization or a government that keeps information from its staff and its members, and it doesn't really seem to keep a lot of information from the crew of the Enterprise. So
episode with the Romulan commander where Kirk and Spock, acting under secret orders, did, you know, brought the ship into Romulan space without telling anybody.
But you're proving my point for me. Kirk and Spock knew that. Kirk and Spock didn't even know that the planet had dilithium crystals. I think that
So what I'm saying is I if they can make a set of orders, give, you know, if they decide a need to know basis that just the, you know, captain and the first officer need to know something, that's one thing. They could decide even that the captain and the first officer are not in the need to know basis.
I guess, but I don't.
It's plausible.
Maybe. I don't know. I don't buy it because dilithium crystals are not really that much of a secret. And it doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense to me to keep that secret because of what other purpose would they have to be there? And then, of course, you might want your starship captain to know that he can get a new supply of dilithium crystals if he needs to. Dilithium in the show has always been something that is rare and valuable and is not commonly found. And so At least having your starship captains know under confidential orders where the dilithium crystals can be found in the galaxy seems to me to be like a good operating procedure.
Maybe, but number one, it's... I mean, anytime I hear dilithium, I read oil, so, or coal, or, you know, whatever.
That's basically what it is, yeah.
So, I mean, when you're talking about oil, you know, to know where there is a... You know, that's like telling a ship's captain, all right, well, I'm going to tell you where all the crude oil deposits are, so in case you need to refill your ship, you know.
Not necessarily, because dilithium crystals don't need to be refined.
Well, they specifically say that the ones that they have in the, you know, on the necklace, they said they're crude, you know, and they're weirdly shaped. So they may, while they may not need to be refined... They may need to be – I mean, do they need to be – I got the sense they needed to be cut in a certain way.
Yeah, they do, but like that. They can be used. And so I think in a pinch – my point is basically that in a disaster sort of situation where all your dilithium crystals have been damaged, you can use the uncut dilithium crystals to fix your ship. Whereas
as they do, yeah.
If if a battleship runs out of gas or whatever, I don't really know what they use, diesel, I suppose, I don't know. But, you know, yeah. If they run out of diesel fuel, they're not going to pull up into the, you know, Gulf of Mexico and fill it up with crude. That's not going to work. So it's the analogy doesn't exactly
just
work for me.
Just take a bucket and scoop it up. Yeah. I mean, that's fair. At the end of the day, it's one of those, I'm suggesting this mostly because that it's a scaffolding to fix a plot hole, honestly.
Yeah, sure.
And it's one of those...
But it was.
It's interesting because you don't think this point works because you have you're basically saying the Federation wouldn't do that. They would have no reason to. And I'm saying I wouldn't necessarily not trust the Federation to hide certain things, knowing how a military organization or military-ish
well,
would work. I mean,
well, let's not go crazy and start calling Starfleet a military organization.
And that is a fair point. The point is I can see it being to their advantage in certain situations to keep certain things from certain people.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of my view of this is colored by having a much more broad and diffuse understanding of Star Trek than you do. I mean, you've basically
certainly.
Only seen, you know, 2.5 seasons of the original series.
Where the Federation is only sort of...
Yeah.
Or, I even know what it is. I've seen... The thing is, this is a place where a lot of captains have gone rogue. A lot of people have gone rogue. We've seen a lot of evil, you know, and where a lot
as,
of the...
As we'll see.
Yeah, and a lot of the high-up people are kind of dicky at times. So I guess I wouldn't put it past them.
Okay, that's fair.
But again, this is something that's where I'm essentially making up in order to just mortar something up rather
yeah.
than... So I'm, you know...
Well, what do you make of the ambassador? Because I feel like he should be an interesting character, but he doesn't ever really get developed enough for me to care about. And I don't really get a sense of exactly why these two planets hate each other so much. And that seems to be sort of necessary for the plot to function as it is. It's very, very ill-defined, I think.
Yeah, I mean... I didn't – when the show says two planets are at war with each other, it's done it enough times that I have given up trying to get a reason for the war. And
which I think is a problem though because Star Trek at its best is a show about ideas. And so – and that's a problem with I think a lot of the third season in general is that it's become much more of a pulpy action show than a show about ideas. And – That's a problem, I think.
But at the same time, one of the – in this episode particularly, the show doesn't find war, and this war especially, to be valid. So if they had said, well, the reason they were fighting is because at one point this happened and, you know, this side had a legitimate grievance or it was all a misunderstanding that got blown – you know, no matter what it was, I think giving it a reason – allows for the possibility of justification. In this case, though, the show, the Federation, the show, everybody is fairly unambiguously certain that war between these two planets is not a good idea, and, you know, this may not be the nicest solution, but again, a royal marriage is one of the easiest ways of getting an alliance.
Yeah.
So They figured this is the quickest way to get peace in this territory. That kind of trumps everything.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder, though, because, you know, we don't really get it. I think the episode would have been stronger if we had got a sense of who the people in power of the two planets were, because of course the ambassador is not in charge.
Yeah.
And Elan is not in charge. So
yeah, she mentions a council or something like that.
Right. And so we don't really get a sense of what their government is like. And I think that also hurts the episode. And I think it hurts the episode because, again, if the episode had been much more structured on the level of, okay, we're just going to teach this uncouth, uncivilized woman how to be, you know, a member of the Federation and how to be, you know, how to have manners.
Which
and that's
itself
something else.
Is extremely problematic in so many ways.
I don't necessarily think so.
It is and it's not. Given that she is extremely violent and condescending and, you know, nasty. I mean, those are fairly negative traits.
The men are too, though. I mean, to be fair.
Yes.
It's not. I mean,
there are some cultural relativism issues that does bring up, which the show doesn't question. And I don't know if it's good or bad that it doesn't.
Well, I think that's something that the show doesn't necessarily question the assumptions that Kirk is working under, but I don't get the sense from the show that it would have focused so much on teaching Elan manners if she wasn't going to live on a planet where these manners were important.
At the same time, you know what I mean? Like, it makes her people be unambiguously savage. It's not like we're talking about manners such as what Soup Spoon to use. I mean, it's not like it's talking about, because in any
which is weird because she's basically dressed up like a Greek, for like an ancient Greek person. So, you know, they're kind of mannered, I think, in general. We kind of think of them as that. Maybe Egyptian, I don't know. It's some sort of weird, like, if, you know, 3000 BC,
me of like an Egyptian, like, you know,
I can, yeah, I can see
thing,
like Egyptian stuff and I can see Greek stuff. I mean, sort of like
I got the sense it wasn't supposed to be any particular culture.
Greek,
although there
Greek,
was
Greek kind of clicked in for me because of the Elysians
and
that kind
of
stuff.
And Helen
of
Troy, the pun on that, which right. They don't really do much with, but anyway,
maybe it was supposed to be sort of like an Athens Troy thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. That's interesting. I mean, maybe
she doesn't. The title of it seems to parallel Helen of Troy, but she doesn't really fit that myth.
Well, I mean, let's think about this for a second. So if Troia is supposed to be like Athens, because that's the culture, you know, effete sort of planet, and Elas is supposed to be Troy.
Sparta,
that's what I'm thinking of, Sparta. So, you know, maybe that's sort of where they were going with this. I don't know that there's much to talk about
I don't know.
There's a lot of different directions that this episode could have gone in that probably would have been better than what we got. But we get isn't bad.
It's the typical season three of, with a bit more work, it could have been a very good episode. But it needed a bit less work than, for example, any of the ones we've seen. Basically it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I
enjoyed the episode.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I just want to go back to your thing about the manners for a minute, because I don't know. I want to challenge you on that. I don't think that the show is questioning her as incorrect. I think it's questioning her as, this is not how you act in this situation. And if the ambassador had been playing a character who was going to a loss to get married, I think you would have had a much different episode. And I think it would have been,
don't use a fork, you have to rip into it with your teeth.
Yeah, no, I'm serious though. I mean, I don't get the sense from the show that it's really judging her. I think it's more you know, it's more like saying, this is what you need to do to get by. And I think if you look at it in that sense, the episode isn't as problematic as we're making it out to be.
They're a planet of savages, and she's the queen savage, and she has to be civilized, and Kirk is going to spank her until that happens. I mean, do I need to spell out the subtext more explicitly?
Well, the spanking is a problem. That is definitely a problem.
I'm glad you agree.
That's, again, why I think it would have been better if she had been aged downward.
So you can have Kirk spanking a 12-year-old girl? I mean, is this what you want to see in television? Because
I don't really want to see any of it.
We could go to Japan and have that happen.
Yeah.
It's on, like, their soap operas.
Okay. Well, is there anything else we can talk about with this episode? I do want to mention, if there's nothing else of great import that you would like to talk about, the costuming in this episode. It's not good.
This is
something that I've been wanting to bring up for a while, but I was waiting for an opportune moment. And I think this episode provides an opportune moment, because the costuming of Elan, I don't think, is necessarily that much of a problem. It's not great, but it's a little overblown, and it's very third season-ish. But the costumes that her guards are wearing are, I'm sorry, they're fucking ridiculous. There's something straight out of, like, 1955, really bad pulp sci-fi. And William Ware Thies was the guy who worked on costuming for all three seasons of the show. And I don't know why he started going in this direction in the third season. I sort of looked it up and I didn't really get any, like, good answers. The first two seasons really went more, I mean, they were definitely sci-fi and they weren't naturalistic clothing necessarily, but it wasn't as really ridiculously goofy as what the men in this episode were wearing.
It's one of those costume decisions that makes you embarrassed to be watching the show.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Put it this way, like, the uniforms of the Enterprise, they're iconic. Anybody sees that, that's fine. That's one of those costume designs that, you know, has gone down in costume history for good reason. That is an amazing starship uniform.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I loved the dress that was, like, hands over the boobs and, like, lace. That was fun.
Yeah, the whole thing is just not good. And
they're not even hiding the fact that the women are cheesecake at this point, which, again, I think I said this, that's fine, but not in this show.
Well, especially if you think about what the women in Wink of an Eye were wearing, right? Like, with that, it was like that silver,
yeah,
X thing over the boobs and the really, really short skirts and the really big hair. I mean, this is where Star Trek gets its reputation as sort of like this pulpy nonsense. And yeah, it's always driven me crazy because the show really was not like that for the first two seasons. And I think the third season of the show is, you know, I think as at this point we've seen enough of it that we can say it feels like maybe a different show. And that's one of the things I don't like about it, is just the way that the costumes went in the third season. So,
but I mean, she's fucking hot.
Is she? Yeah. I don't think so.
Well, oh well.
All right. Well, how many tribbles would you give this one?
6, and let's never speak of it again.
Yeah, give it like a 5. It's fine.
You liked this a lot better when you started this.
I mean, you know, what can I say? I can't say much.
Okay.
All we can do now is move on to Whom Gods Destroy.
So when I watched this episode, I watched half of it, had some stuff to do, finished the second half the next day, and right before I was about to watch it, I realized I did not remember a single thing about the episode going into the second half.
That's a problem.
That's pretty much all what I like. That's my take on this episode. It should have been cool, but it just was kind of there.
Well, I liked it more when it was called Dagger of the Mind. And also, and the similarities, I don't know if you remember that one from
Which
the
one
first
was that?
Season. That was the criminally insane planet with the guy who had the agony booth from the first season. Captured them, kept them on the planet. He was actually criminally insane. the inmates took it over. I'm basically describing the plot of Whom Gods Destroy.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I remember that episode.
In the Star Trek compendium, I read that maybe it wasn't in the Star Trek compendium. One of the many detail oriented things that I read when I prepare for the show. But I think it was Memory Alpha. Leonard Nimoy had actually written a couple of memos to the producers about this episode. One of which was basically, "Hey, we did this episode. It was called Dagger of the Mind." and another one was, I don't like the end of it because basically the director had decided to turn it into a fight sequence. But we'll get to that. Yeah, it's not great.
No.
It's not terrible.
No.
I was entertained by it. Okay. I wasn't bored by it. And I think that's primarily what I look for in the third season is things that I am not bored by. And I didn't really find any of it tedious. And I liked the actor who played Garth. Aside from that, it's kind of there.
I could tell that a lot of the episode worked with whether or not you like Garth and the actor who played Garth, and I particularly didn't. For no real reason, he just didn't hit me. I didn't click to the character.
Well, no, he wouldn't hit you. He would use a phaser.
Ew. He would hit me with the phaser.
Well, no, let's talk about that. I mean, why do you think you didn't like him? I mean, I'm not saying that I thought he was like a classic character or anything, but, I thought he was entertaining enough.
It's in a show that's had Mudd and Khan and Trelane and, you know, it just, I guess that's it. Like, when you talk
about... Hey, you remember Trelane's name. Good for you.
I didn't realize that was the real name. I was making just some shit up.
Okay.
The lady from the Ponfar episode, like, the show has had so many really amazing villains or guest characters or that.
Yeah, I was about to say, don't call T'Pau a villain.
No, she's an antagonist, but not a villain, I would say. Either way, one of the most memorable guest spots in the series.
Yeah.
If you line up all of the guest stars, I don't find Garth anywhere near the top. I think it may be as simple as that. It's just, he makes me long for better villains.
Okay. All right.
There wasn't anything particularly to him. It's just like, oh, he has the psychic shifty powers. He's crazy. He's arrogant. He used to be a starship commander. Yes, that's unique. We've never seen any combination of that before in a Star Trek episode. I guess that was it. There was nothing really to him.
I guess if the main problem with this episode can be summarized basically by this, it doesn't seem dangerous. And I think you need this episode to feel dangerous. Garth is kind of dangerous, but he's also kind of goofy. And, you know, especially that long scene, which lasts for about 10 minutes where they're at dinner and, you know, Kirk and Spock are sort of conspiring with each other. And you know, Spock is saying, well, if you can make a diversion, I can get away and I can save the day and blah, blah, blah.
Did they even do that?
No, they didn't.
Yeah, okay. I didn't think it was just me or like.
They just sort of forgot about it.
Well, because then like Green Lady, you know.
Started dancing.
I love the fact that like the soles of her feet did not have the green paint on it and the camera did not take that into account.
I didn't notice that.
Yeah. Like
it's really weird what you notice. Like, you notice things that I would not even pay attention to.
Yeah.
But then you don't remember names. It's the weirdest thing.
Well, because names are stupid. They're all like, you know, Kapow and Bazang. And,
they're
you
not
know.
Like that. Don't be ridiculous. Elba 2, which was the planet name in this episode. And I remember that because, of course, Elba was the island that Napoleon was exiled to.
Oh my God, that's awesome. And when people are crazy, they think they're Napoleon.
Yeah. You know, and there's, yeah, like that, there's that long scene where they're at dinner and it's sort of like going back and forth. And, you know, I think that they were trying to go for a certain amount of Hannibal Lecter-ness in this episode. He wasn't supposed to be a cannibal, but I think he probably should have been seen as dangerous.
It probably
would have helped the episode if they had had a red shirt beam down with them that he killed.
Yeah.
that would have made him seem a lot more dangerous. And they don't do that, which is strange.
I was going to say, to even have him, like, this dinner is not threatening at all. It's just a weird little dinner. Like,
you know what? That scene reminded me out of something from the 1960s Batman show for some reason.
Yeah.
Where it just seemed like sort of this, like, cavalcade of supervillains. Yeah. You know, and they've all kind of got these weird costumes on, and you've got the Green Lady, and you've got Garth of Izar, and you've got the Andorian, you've got the Tellarite, and you've got the other two guys, and, you know, like, just, I don't know, it just struck me as a kind of weird, like, really, like, hey, this is 1969 now, we're gonna act insane, and it doesn't work.
It should have been scary, not crazy. I mean, you have him having this very threatening dinner, the red shirt says something, he kills the red shirt and just makes them eat with the red shirt's body there, like, something like that.
Yeah, that would have been good.
That would have been fine, that would have established, because all he does is put them in this, you know, brain scream, you know, thingy that makes, now I have to say the sound effect on that was extremely unpleasant, and it did set my teeth on edge watching it.
Really? Yes. It didn't bother me at all.
Well, fuck you. I'm sorry my ears suck.
Okay. I mean, I do believe that, yes. I do believe that that was the prop from Dagger of the Mind, by the way. So it was even, like, down to the prop level, it was the same episode.
Which, I mean, like, comic books do that all the time, but they usually wait a good 5 to 7 years. This was, like, from season 1 to season 3.
Yeah. This was the first episode of the 3rd season, by the way, aired in 1969. So we are now in the last decade of the 60s, if you were wondering.
Oh.
You know, and the funny thing is they do actually have Garth kill someone later, and so the green skinned lady, who I think we're supposed to assume is an Orion, they're all insane. This is a planet for the criminally insane. There's only a few inmates because it's been established in this episode that the Federation has basically cured mental illness, except for, like, homicidal criminal insanity, which, okay. And
that's another problematic thing.
It is. Yeah. We can get into that. Garth apparently also can shapeshift, which, okay, even though I think he's supposed to be a human, but oh, right,
they gave
whatever.
A reason for that, and was basically, we really wanted to have a scene where Kirk fights Kirk, so that's why he's a shapeshifter. I mean, that's what I got from that.
Yeah. And so Garth has been, they're obviously in some sort of relationship, Garth and the green-skinned woman, and he's very, very, very dismissive, rude, and mean to her. And threatens violence many times against this woman. And I think that a show that was made in a different era, that would have come across as much more threatening than it does in this episode. Because, of course, this was still the age when domestic violence was kind of treated as a joke. And so when he does actually follow through on his threats and takes her outside into the poisonous atmosphere and then has her blown up, it really comes out of left field and doesn't fit the feel of the episode at all.
See, I want to counter you saying, you know, that was the era of, you know, and that was a thing, by pointing out in, you know, Space Seed, when Khan is essentially acting very similarly towards the, you know, the woman who he ends up with, like, it's seen as creepy as hell. Like, that's him being, but it's one of those, I saw, you know, Ricardo Montalban was able to pull off that role, having the raw sexuality and the power and the commandingness that you need. Like, I completely bought she was acting like that towards him, because he was completely, you know, he had that note perfect, and it was terrifying.
Whereas the guy who plays Garth of Izar looks like your friend's dad.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thought experiment. If Garth of Izar had been played by Ricardo Montalban, do you think this would have been a different episode?
Well, yeah, because, again, you know, Khan is writing, but Khan is also performance. You know, that's one of those great season one, season two guest performances that we don't get as much anymore.
Yeah, but, yeah.
I think that would have helped it a lot. It still wouldn't have been as strong of an episode, but at least there would have been more of a tension. I mean,
as it is, it almost comes across as some sort of, like, folly, because they escape, they get captured, they escape again, they get captured again. The very end of the episode turns into this sort of like Batman-esque fight between Kirk and Garth, and then you've got this, you know, Garth decides to look like Kirk, and Spock has to decide which is which, and he sort of like goads them into fighting, which is what Leonard Nimoy didn't like, because apparently in the original script, Spock had asked them a series of questions, and then he basically stuns Garth, decides correctly and stuns Garth. And that would have been maybe a little better because, you know, like I said in the previous segment, you know, Star Trek has always been a good show when it's about ideas more than when it's about action. I don't know that it would have made it a classic episode by any means, but it certainly would have been more interesting.
Well, what eventually gets Spock to realize is after they have this fight, you know, the real Kirk says, you know, shoot us both. It's the only way to make sure, which number one, getting stunned by a phaser apparently sucks, but it's not the worst thing in the world. So number one, why Spock didn't immediately just do that to both of them.
That's what I thought when he opened that door and saw two Kirks.
It's just like logically.
That was my immediate reaction. Just stun both of them. Call the Enterprise, give the code, and then you're done.
Yeah. Like
we're done. The episode's over.
Kirk will be able to deal with getting stunned, you know?
He's done it before. He will be able to get over it this time.
Yeah. There were some moments in the, this business with the code is odd. I loved the scene when, you know, Spock gets there and he's just like, you know, what's the code, Cap? You know, all right, Captain, what's the code? And like, just Kirk gives that, oh shit. Like the second Spock says that, he realizes, like, I loved that moment. Like, that was a very...
Yeah, what did you think of the fake out? Did you pick up on that, or were you surprised?
I got it the second Kirk said it, like, oh, like...
So I had never actually seen this episode before, and I totally didn't pick up on the fake out until that moment as well. And I was like, oh, that's cool. Okay, this episode is a little smarter than I thought it was.
But the thing is... And I'm trying to remember the episode with this happened, but it's been established that there are codes on the Enterprise that... So I thought it was great that he has this, you know, secret code that he has before he beams up. Like, I thought that was great. Why it took Scotty more than 20 seconds to realize that, you know, Captain doesn't know the code and says he's testing me. You know, I wonder, do you think, like, why he had to even go through the thought process was...
Well, probably because the episode was running short, as a lot of third season episodes did.
But the thing is, they've established that they also have a secondary code, which basically means, like, something's up, but I don't want you to know that, you know, them to know that.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
I'm letting you know something's up. So basically, beam up's up, but just have, like, 20 phasers pointed at us and sorted out, you know, when you get in. Like, you would think that they would have two chess moves, and they would just say, like, the... All right, you know, it's this one. You know, like, that felt, again, that seems a very common standard procedure that they should be following.
Yeah. I mean, I was under the assumption that he put that in place specifically for this mission because he was beaming down to a planet of criminally insane people. And so you want to have some sort of safeguard in place to make sure that none of the criminally insane people are beaming up with your captain.
And I mean, I actually assume that there would be some kind of a procedure in place like that, some kind of clearance in general, except just, you know, this is a television show. So that's, you know, considered just, you know, it's a little non-diegetic in a way because you know, we don't want to see them going through, you know, just you never have someone go to the bathroom on TV. You never have them going through the password.
Unless it's a major plot point.
Exactly. So in this episode, that was relevant. You know, I assume there's just some kind of thing like that.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that definitely is something, you know, you don't see people sneeze on television. You don't see people cough on television unless it's relevant. You don't really see people eat on television unless it's relevant.
Again, this is making something up to fill in, and it doesn't really matter either way.
Yeah. But I think it's a fine point.
Yeah. I also love how when they're at the talent show, you know, at dinner, they're playing wheelbarrow and that's the entertainment.
Yeah, it's
that was pretty much my favorite moment of this episode because I would enjoy that.
Well, I thought that this episode, you know, if it had either gone in a criminally insane, terrifying way, or if it had gone in a sort of Island of Misfit Toys way, if it had gone in either of those two directions, I feel like it would have been a stronger episode, but it really couldn't commit to either one, and so it sort of just had this middle path that wasn't really super interesting.
Well, that sounds like an underwritten third season episode.
How about that? What do you make of the idea that they have a cure for criminal insanity now?
I mean...
Which apparently I don't think ever comes up again, which is weird, but whatever.
Oh, they do it at the end. They're like, in, you know, injecting or something.
No,
like that.
I mean like in later like seasons of Star Trek.
I don't know.
Like, we've got criminally insane people in later seasons of Star Trek, and they don't go, oh, we've got medicine for that. You know, I don't know.
I mean, on the one hand, yes, you know, alternative brain chemistry and, you know, disorders and things like that are things.
Yeah.
That being said, it's also a 1969 interpretation of mental illness, which is worlds different from what we have, you know, today's understanding of it. And so it is something that I find extremely troubling, and yet, you know, it is one of those things, and I rarely admit to this, but you need to just accept that it can exist, even though I think scientifically it makes no sense for that to be a thing. Like, criminal insanity is not a one-time disease, you know what I mean? Like, that's...
Well, I think you're not giving that enough credit, because the popular understanding of mental illness, I think, in 1969 was a lot less sympathetic than it is nowadays.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I can't necessarily say that the understanding of mental illness is super sympathetic even today, but there is a much more of a broad understanding that most mental illness is biological in origin.
Yeah.
And so having a medical cure for criminal insanity, I'm going to keep saying that because that's what the episode is saying, even though I don't really – that's not a distinction that we would make if you're talking about a cure.
That's a lot, I guess, of it. It doesn't – that phrase, cure for mental insanity – for criminal insanity makes no logical sense. That's like
It might be better to say, like, you know, we have a cure for a specific type of schizophrenia or something.
Yes, and that is obviously what we're intended to – you know, you don't need to make that much of a translation to read it as that.
Yeah. But I think that's one of the bright spots in the episode, because I do like the idea that they don't hold any grudges against Garth of Izar. They understand that he is ill. And even though the episode is not very thoughtful about that, the very end of the episode, I think, is where, you know, Kirk realizes that, you know, this is a very sick individual who needs medical attention and needs medical help.
Yeah.
And McCoy is providing it to him. And so when the cure goes through his system and begins to work and repairs the damage, whatever damage that is, I mean, we don't even really know nowadays.
Yeah.
But let's just assume it's some sort of, you know, biological brain disorder.
Yeah, they implied that mental illness was a brain damage thing.
Right.
Okay.
You know, it can be. It's not brain damage, but it's your brain operating in a different fashion, let's say. And so I like that, because Kirk doesn't hold any grudges towards Garth, and just as if Garth had been in pain and was lashing out in the same fashion that it's viewed in that sense, which I think is That's a much more optimistic view of it than I think the show in the third season has shown a lot of times. And I think that's probably the moment in the episode where it feels most like Star Trek.
And that's fair. I don't know. It just kind of was an episode. And I think that's the thing. It didn't do anything particularly interesting. Nothing really stood out. And I couldn't really care.
Yeah, I think the episode probably would have been much stronger if we had seen more of the main cast.
Yeah.
And I think that's also been a problem with a lot of third season episodes, where
it's
mostly Kirk and Spock on some planet and they're alone for most of the episode. And that's fine, but when you're doing that almost every episode, it does get a bit old. And the episode could have been stronger if we had had... You know, because McCoy and Scotty up on the ship.
Yeah, and Scotty's always in charge now.
Yeah, because Spock is down there with him, and I guess he's supposed to be third in command.
Yeah.
But it's strange because, you know, they're sort of talking about how they can try and rescue them, and they can, you know, the phasers, because the asylum has a shield, I guess, so that to keep the atmosphere out, and also so people can't beam in and out. And then they go, oh, well, we could try this thing to save them. And it's like, well, why didn't you try that 20 minutes ago? You know, that kind of just little things like that, which don't really jive.
Yeah, it was a half-assed season three episode.
Yeah, yeah. So maybe the final thing that we can talk about with Whom Gods Destroy is Governor Corey. We didn't really even mention his character, and
well, the show barely does. Like,
yeah, and I think it's a little weird because, again, tonally, I think the episode it just shows how tonally skewed the episode is, because when Kirk and Spock first beam down to the planet, Garth is imitating Governor Corey, and the fact that he's a governor is weird.
He turns out to be the entire staff of the entire...
Yeah, there's no one else down there.
Who cooks meals? Like, that's one thing. Like, what if the governor gets
the food dispensers.
Who cleans the toilets?
Let's not talk about toilets. They have that coating that the, you know, waterless urinals have on them.
I hate that.
Yeah, but they don't get cleaned.
Yeah, I know. They're always, like, skanky.
Yeah, I know. It doesn't work.
They needed to have somebody running the place, but they couldn't figure out what to do with him or how to write an interesting character, so...
Well, he just sort of disappears, and I think, like, that again, like, your first introduction to this episode is, oh, here is Garth, who is obviously going to be the antagonist of this episode, torturing someone.
Yeah.
And they don't really do anything with it, and they just sort of leave it. That's also problematic.
And he tortures the governor to get Kirk to talk.
Yeah. Yeah, he puts...
That happens.
He puts him in the therapeutic thing that you can also apparently turn on for pain and tortures him. And so that's not good either.
No.
So there's a lot of problematic elements to this episode, I would say.
Fucking Garth. Ugh.
All right, well, how many tribbles would you give Whom Gods Destroy?
3.5, because the proper use of whom.
Okay, that's good. I actually read an article that whom is dying out. So
good.
This might be the last time you hear it.
Yes.
I will give it 4.
Okay.
Because why not?
Because you have to be one better than me.
I always am. All right, so next week we are going to cover Let That Be Your Last Battlefield and The Mark of Gideon. So look forward to those.